One of the questions many of us hold as we look at the state of the world is, how can I be of help? When we have access to resources others don't, or our voices are going to be given more clout in a situation due to privilege, or when we see injustice and know that we are less likely to be harmed if we insert ourselves, we have a duty to act and speak. But there is always the possibility that we will fall into the trap of being the savior, or that we'll be so convinced of ourselves as good people that we aren't listening to the groups we are trying to support, and therefore causing harm. Today's episode is a collaboration with a previous guest from Everything is Workable, Lynn Langell, on how to be an ally. The first piece of guidance she gives is the importance of understanding that being an ally isn't something we choose for ourselves. It is something we earn, and to earn it, we must do the work of education, learning to see the world from another person's shoes, even when we have not walked in them, and learning to see the limitations of our experience. She expands this to include working with people who share the same privileges as us, but are not doing the same work, or think that they are, but perhaps haven't gotten quite as far. No matter who the person is, she says, we can ask, what is their story? As a reminder that until we listen, we can never know. Thank you so much for joining me again on Everything is Workable.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's lovely to have you again. To start off, could you talk a bit about the point at which you first started to take on the role of being an agent for change or an activist, if you identify as an activist?
Oh, labels. So I would say that I started being identified as an activist. So it's not something I embrace for myself, but externally I started being identified that way probably when I became more vocal inside my own marginalized communities. So I started doing education and sort of, I'm trying to think of the best way to group it all together. So there was education and then just sort of visibility around femme lesbians and around bisexual people, around pansexuality and around the trans community. And so I don't hesitate to speak. I've got a pretty big mouth and I like to use it. And I'm really observant and I notice when there are groups that are being maybe silenced or muted or ignored, targeted, however you want to look at it, and unnecessarily so or unjustly so. And so I thought, I'm not afraid to use my voice. I'm not afraid to do research and educate myself in these issues. And I'm invested in them because it's all part of my life, my community. So why wouldn't I speak up on behalf of other people? So it's interesting because that's when it started. And it wasn't until years later that I realized I really started on the wrong foot, because I love to jump out front and be the voice of the people that I wasn't necessarily directly identified as.
So how long ago was it first? Because I think that's interesting, actually, because like when I was a teenager, for example, I was an activist and I did start out on the wrong foot. Like basically my activism when I was 15 was telling other people what they should do, which is a terrible, terrible way to do activism.
Oh, this would have been probably 15 years ago. So I was in, just the cusp of 30. That was also when I re-entered the community. I came out into my different marginalized communities very young. I came out when I was 15 and didn't know who I was, had no sense of my own identity, and then ended up going back into the closet and completely away from everything authentic about me for a decade while I got involved in a terrible religion and a terrible marriage. And it was when I left all of that, because I was like, wait a minute, that's not who I am, and got to fully embrace who I was, like really figured that out, went, whoa, here's who I am, here's where my voice should come from, here's, you know what I mean, like, yeah. Could stand up for myself, had my own self-esteem, my own self-identity, then that enabled me to look around and go, whoa, if I can speak for me, I can speak for you too. Yeah. So yeah, right, like just my early 30s.
Okay, this is a really good point. I'm going to make a note of that, and we're going to come back to that about identity and self-awareness. But I really want to establish what we're going to talk about today, which is about being an ally and what that means. And I think one of the most important first things that I've ever learned about being an ally is that being an ally is like being cool. If you claim a label for yourself, it's probably not true.
That's so accurate. And it's so interesting because especially now with social media the way that it is, mm-hmm. and the instantaneous way that you can share experiences and get information and connect to a community or connect to a cause or an issue, people are like nanosecond quick to say, I'm an ally because I don't hurt them. And they throw their hand in the air and they're like, well, I'm an ally because I'm not a racist. I'm an ally because I'm not homophobic. I'm an ally because I'm not misogynist. And it's all about them, and those aren't allies. You can absolutely cannot bestow the title of ally upon yourself.
Right.
You cannot.
So how do you define what an ally is?
I look at it sort of from two lenses. So first of all, an ally is someone that a marginalized community recognizes as mm-hmm. someone that actively supports them. So the people you're allying yourself to, whatever community it is, right? So if you're an ally to people of color, if you're an ally to Indigenous folks, it means those groups say yes.
Mm-hmm.
You do the right things. But if you want to focus that lens even tighter, to me, an ally is, first of all, recognized by those groups, and then second, someone that makes space. It's not just about that you're doing something, right? It's not necessarily that you're active, but it's very specifically that your actions are promoting or pushing forward or making space for the voices that are being suppressed. So
right.
not your voice, their voice.
Mm-hmm. There's a relinquishment of privilege.
Absolutely. And a use of your privilege, right? Like, and a use in that you're going to hand it over to the best of your ability. You're going to use every inch of all of the advantages you have that you didn't ask for, but that you were born into or educated into or economically fell into, whatever it is. Acknowledge that you have that and now find a way to use it, support it, share it, give it. Do you know what I mean? Like you said,
yeah.
relinquish it on behalf of the groups that don't have it.
Yeah, it reminds me of a story from Zenji Earthlin Manuel, who talks about attending a conference where there was a panel and there was a cis-identified white man on the stage who says, you know, as this person, I have all this privilege, so it's my duty to help people. And how her heart just sank when she heard that, because he's still buying into the dynamic that he somehow is more valuable and his
yeah.
voice is more valuable, instead of saying, is this falsity of my voice being more valuable, therefore I should probably relinquish my spot on the stage to a person of color.
Yeah, right.
So to come back then to what you were talking about knowing yourself, a lot of the time what we're up against when we're looking at dismantling systems of oppression is the way that the world is taken in very black and white terms, right? Like there's oppressed, oppressor, good people, bad people, right, wrong, you're on one side or the other. But when we actually look at human beings, we realize that we all have really intersectional experiences and views of the world, and we all bring different experiences in from our different experience of being marginalized and of having privilege. So like, in my case, I experienced marginalization because I'm a woman and because I'm queer, but I experienced privilege because I come from a middle-class background and I'm white and I speak English. And I'm thin in there as well, because that is totally a thing, thin privilege.
Yep. Yeah, unfortunately.
How do you draw on your experiences of marginalization and experiences of privilege? So basically, how do you draw on your awareness of yourself and knowing who you are in the world to help you to be a better ally?
For me, the key is that visual empathy. So literally putting yourself in their shoes. I find that I have this constant dialogue in my head that's talking about, I try and get really granular. It's like, so my privilege is I have a home that I own. Mm-hmm. I have education. I have a really good job. I'm white. I am like firmly middle class. I have a fridge full of food. I could go out and eat if I wanted to at a restaurant. I can plan a vacation. All of those things are privilege. I don't have food insecurity. I don't have home insecurity. I don't have job. Do you know what I mean? I listed in my head all of the things that these other communities don't have. And it's this constant comparison of, wow, I don't think twice about driving home alone at night. Because if I get stopped, nothing's going to happen to me. It's all of those things I don't think twice about. I'm not nervous about. And I feel like I'm talking in circles a little bit to try and get to the answer. Because it's not a singular thing. It's a conversation you have with yourself constantly. Mm-hmm. It's making yourself aware. And the clearest way to do that is, to be blunt, to shut up and listen. So you need to sit down with a trans person, a person of color, a trans person of color, an indigenous person, a survivor of residential schools. You need to sit down with these people and sincerely say, how is it for you? What can I do? And I'm not advocating to the audience, go out and start these intense interviews of random communities, because that's just going to do more trauma. But when you haven't, like, go and learn however you can. So if you can learn from people firsthand, if there are people that are strong enough to share their experiences and those opportunities exist, do it. It's really important that you do it. If they're not, use the World Wide Web for something good. You know what I mean? Use the internet and actually find Indigenous literature and read the experiences. Look up your history. My wife and I, we were talking to our kids about residential schools and the fact that the last one closed in 1996, and it made us want to find out where they all were. And it's very easy to find, because mm-hmm. the government holds endless information about residential schools. And in a very weird way. And so you can find every single school, what it was called, how it was classified, whether it was supported by a religious organization or not, because they weren't all. Mm-hmm. When they opened, when they closed, how many students moved through them. We found out there were 4 in Calgary. 4. Mm-hmm. And it took us like an hour of our time. So it's making that effort to actually drop yourself into these shoes, right? Because then your motivation is different. Your motivation is from a place of, I want to say knowledge and not understanding, because the understanding comes over time and over hearing the experiences and believing and learning, right? You can get knowledge right away, but then your motivation comes from there, right? Your motivation comes from not it's the right thing to do, but holy crap, that is devastatingly shitty, and I can do something about it.
You said there about believing, and I think that is a huge part of it that's very challenging, especially when we're looking at the way that we think of ourselves as good people.
Mm, yep.
And when we think of ourselves as good people, and then someone confronts us with something like, oh, well, actually, what you may have learned in school about residential schools was probably not the truth, or
yeah,
was simply just not enough information. And there's this sense of like, oh, but I'm a good person, and I didn't have anything to do with that. And this is, you know, we need to move on and move forward and so on and so forth. And there's this sense of like, I'm not gonna, like, if I close my ears and don't listen to it, then I don't have to deal with the unpleasantness.
Yep.
So have you worked with that? Like, how have you personally developed a way to sit with the discomfort of listening to the truth of someone else and listening to it and hearing it as true?
For me, the key is being willing to be uncomfortable. And like eagerly so, Like, I'm, as I'm learning these things, I'm expecting to be uncomfortable. And I'm seeking out that discomfort. So I grew up north of the city of Calgary. Lots of rural areas. We've got Tsutsina land and Siksika land. And, what's the other? Well, there's three reserves around us. It's terrible that I actually right now can't remember the third. And my mom drove bus back and forth from Airdrie to Morley, which was at reserve land. And so we did a lot of things on Indigenous land. We went to hockey tournaments and powwows and different things. And when I was young, it just was.
Mm-hmm.
This was just a place you went. It was different, but you didn't register it as anything except just different than the city. And then as a young adult, when I was involved poorly with a very horrible group of people, and they used to proselytize out on these same reserves.
Mm-hmm.
And the comments that I absorbed were, well, all the stereotypes that you could imagine that yeah. existed about a reserve were just repeated constantly. And then when I worked with a dog rescue, even after that, the same thing, right? Oh, these are res dogs. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when we go and do clinic on the res, etc. No empathy, no seeking of knowledge, just judgment, 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 judgment. And I absorbed a lot of that. And so what changed things for me was, and I don't even, like, I couldn't pinpoint it. It's not one of those things where I could tell you when it changed, but I realized what I knew was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What I knew wasn't based in fact. And so I started asking questions. I started researching, well, why were the reserves created? What is it really like there? Like, for me, I had to admit that yeah. I was an asshole.
Yeah, the admission thing, right? Like, you can't work with something that you don't acknowledge. I like to say that a lot, right? I was like, if you don't say it's there, then you can't do anything about it. So it's like one of the big steps that I took in doing the work that I'm doing around being aware of my white privilege is going, I'm a racist. I'm a racist. I was raised in a white colonial society. I am going to have implicit biases. They are not conscious to me. They are not things I actually endorse, but they are there. And if I don't say that, I will never see them.
Perfect example is driving to work this morning, feeling a little bit impatient. And I was a passenger. My wife was driving. I was a passenger, but feeling a little bit impatient. And their car in front of us was going slower than the rest of traffic. And so when we finally got around them, out of my own impatience, I gave a sidelong glance over to the driver.
Mm-hmm.
The driver was a visible minority. And I had that split second of I rolled my eyes mm-hmm. and made a judgment and then stopped myself and went, like, what the hell are you doing? There's 100 reasons why they could be driving slower. And they were in the far right lane. They were exactly where they were meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't causing a problem. They weren't obstructing traffic. And it was only like 5 slower than the speed limit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But just that ingrained reaction and then that self-correction of stop it, mm-hmm. you know, like, let's go on the facts, not on the emotional crap you were taught. Because, yeah, you have to admit, like, holy crap, I just did that. You can't go, I'm not a racist. I'm not a bigot. Sure, we are. We all are. We all have moments of that. And we have to find them and correct them constantly. Because we have a lifetime of absorbing it. And it doesn't just erase itself.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to do that work. And I think that's to come back to what you said about the discomfort and
mm-hmm.
looking for it. So it, within Buddhism, karma, greatly, greatly misunderstood karma. There's a description of karma as it's called burning up karma, which is when you sit with the discomfort and you don't do the habitual thing, that's called burning up the karma. So yeah, so karma, I mean, karma is just, it's just energy. That's what it is. And the idea is that we have these habitual patterns that we fall into in the dynamics that we have, the relationships we have. And so the way it's talked about in Buddhism is that when you sit with that, when you see that uncomfortable moment, you go, wow, that thought was racist.
Yeah.
And then you say, that was racist. I'm going to acknowledge that was racist. And that means that was not okay. And it's uncomfortable to do that. But there you go. You just burn some karma.
Cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Look what I learned.
So one of the biggest challenges that I face as an ally is that dynamic of how to stand up for others without reinforcing my own privilege.
Mm.
So it's one thing to acknowledge that being an ally is to acknowledge your privilege and then relinquish it, but like how to go about doing that.
I think the key is, and again, this gets down to educating yourself, and not to throw us onto a tangent, but you have to be careful that you're not demanding to be educated by the very communities that are suffering and that you want to ally to, right?
You know, that's a good tangent. Go on that tangent.
Well, my thought is that, like, we don't want to be throwing all of the emotional labor back on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely something we can carry. We have experiences and information and videos and books and groups and speakers at our fingertips, right? There's ways to get all of that information without sitting some individual down and saying, well, I don't understand your problems. Tell me all about it. Tell me about, you know, the generational impact of residential schools and why the trauma leads to addiction and how it's not your fault. I don't get it. Right? Like, such crap.
Yeah.
Go read a book.
Yeah.
So it's really important that you start with the self-education. And then you make sure that your self-education is coming from the right source. That's really key. Your information should be coming from people that live these experiences, not from other privileged white folk who are just telling you a story that they've never felt. Do you know what I mean? Because then inevitably comes the recommendations, sometimes directly and often indirectly, of what you can do. And there's endless lists out there that, again, help you not throw the responsibility or the labor back onto those groups, right? There's endless sources of information that say, you know, don't become their voice, enable their voice. Use your mm-hmm. privilege to book a panel of other people talking,
mm-hmm.
not you standing there talking about how terrible racism is. But you use your privilege to book a space, pull in an audience, and allow people that experience racism to talk about it and teach about it. Or you use your privilege to make a space for them where it wouldn't otherwise happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Go into your educated white spaces and make room for them and support them. There's so many ways, like even when there's things like demonstrations or, oh, Kate, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know. Protests?
Yes, thank you. Totally gone out of my head. I learned something really amazing this summer about how to use my privilege during protests that people of color were holding.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the encouragement was for me to show up dressed in my work clothes, dressed in my business casual.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a pretty white girl that's obviously educated, obviously has money.
Mm-hmm.
Show up dressed like that and stand with them. When people start coming after them, stand in front of them. Because when the bigots and the racists are looking to fire at someone, they're not going to fire at their mirror image. And that's exactly what I am. So be willing to protect. Yeah, it's just there are so many things you can do where you're actually using the things you didn't ask for a good purpose, where your allyship is active and it's not about you, it's about them.
Yeah, I think that like that's a really key aspect of being an ally, is it's not about you.
No, Lord, no. It's better if nobody knows you're doing it, because that's the point.
Yeah, and so that brings me to then the cringeworthy statement that so many people people who genuinely think of themselves as allies like to use of, oh, well, I know a trans person, I know an indigenous person, I know a black person, I'm friends with, I've, you know, I dated, I have in my family. So what is your response to people who think of themselves as allies and claim their social circle as proof of that while actually not showing any visible like action? Because usually when someone says that, then they immediately follow it up with something really ignorant.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily recommend my response for most people. because I'm a bit of a hardhead. And like, so we had this conversation at work. It's very interesting that you're bringing this up. We had this conversation at work. Well, it'll be 4 weeks ago now, where I had this coworker that I've worked with for a very, very long time, know her relatively well. I don't get super friendly with my colleagues, so, you know, I know her superficially well. And we were talking about trans folk, and there was some stuff in the news about it, and she's like, wow, I know two trans people, so, you know, I'm the perfect ally. And I just looked at her and I'm like, are you really? So I don't recommend everybody doing that. If you're not ready to maybe back that up. But she was flabbergasted. She looked at me and she goes, yes, of course I am. I understand everything. And I'm like, do you? I said, do you deeply understand everything they felt? I said, have you sat there and listened to them talk about how disjointed their lives are and how they're surrounded by people that wish for them to not exist? I said, have you tried to actually feel the tremendous pressure it is just to breathe in their own skin?
It's interesting that you say that that's like, don't respond the way I did, because I think that questions are great. Because as soon as you present someone with those questions, even if they get defensive about it, the point is like, they're there now. You've planted seeds.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's that sort of like, oh, am I? Oh, am I? And I think that's really good. It's like, have you had that conversation with them? Are you someone that they're comfortable having that conversation with? Because like what you were saying before about like, don't go and find somebody and be like, oh, tell me your whole experience of being marginalized. It's more like when you sit down and speak with someone who has an experience of marginalization that is different than your own and you want to be of benefit. It's like what you're saying, right? You have that background. You understand it on an intellectual level from doing your research and reading the stats, like how many trans people are killed, how many trans women of color in particular are killed every year. The discomfort of knowing there are people who, and I can connect with that as a queer woman. I can connect with what it feels like to know that there are people in the world who wish that I didn't exist.
Yeah.
They've never met me.
Right.
And they hate me. And that is heartbreaking. And so like you bring that quality to it. And so when you're sitting down with someone, you're not saying like, tell me your whole experience. You're saying like, what can I do to be of help? So again, questions. It's like when you're confronting that ignorance in someone and when you're also working to be a better ally and you are, instead of assuming you know the answers, assuming you know you're a good ally.
Well, and I think the key and part of why I said don't do what I do is because I get defensive. I get defensive and I get angry. I get angry at people's stupidity. And stupidity in the sense of the actual ignorance. Like I think many sincerely don't realize that they're not what they say they are. Admittedly, I'm a little bit tired. And so I get angry and defensive right away, and I like to sort of tear a strip off people. And so you're right. The questions are good. Don't ask them with anger. Don't ask them with accusation. Ask them with curiosity. Ask them with love and kindness, because then it'll work, right? Then it'll be, you say you're an ally, right? And then whatever questions you want to ask. And you're right. That absolutely does disarm and potentially open up the conversation for, are you really? Tell me about it. Tell me about how you're an ally. No, you said that already. Tell me something else. No, you said that same sentence already. Tell me something else.
I think if we could go back, you said about asking something from a place of love.
Mm.
So that's a big practice of mine.
Oof. It's a should be a practice for all of us.
It should be, yeah. Because what that is saying is that this person that you are confronting, you see them as a full human being, right? You see that, like, you are not just a racist. None of us is just one singular thing. We've already talked about that. We all have different experiences of being marginalized and having privilege.
Yeah.
And so it's about confronting the ignorance, not them, not attacking them as a person, but like going after whatever the idea is. And to me, that's what I understand is like coming from a place of love.
Mm-hmm.
So what are things that you do to check that that's your motivation when you're doing this kind of work?
When I find that I'm getting into those types of conversations, when I can feel sort of my ire starting to rise, this is something I'm actually really actively practicing right now because I'm feeling tired and a bit burnt out, is the first thing I ask myself is, what is their story? And 99% of the time, my answer is, I don't know. And so when you don't know their story, you need to check yourself. You don't know why they're saying what they are. You don't know why they believe what they believe. And people can sincerely believe the wrong thing because they've never been shown anything different. People can think they're being helpful and not realize they're being harmful because no one's ever told them or shown them they're being harmful. And so for me, I'm constantly in my interactions, especially with people that I don't have a deep relationship with, I constantly am, what is their story? And when my answer is, I don't know, which is almost always, then that puts me back into my very favorite place of curiosity. Because if you're curious, it means you want to know, right? If you approach everything from this place of curiosity, then there's that, again, that deep seed of love, because there's a desire. There's a desire to know, to understand, to exchange. Right? It doesn't become, I'm going to overpower you, I'm right, I'm going to convince you, I'm going to persuade you. It's, how is it for you? Tell me, how is it for you? Why do you think that? Why do you believe that? Why do you say that? Tell me about that. And it changes the tone of everything, it changes the direction, and it changes the ability for the person to be defensive, because you're not attacking.
I think as well what you said about having a relationship with the person.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Because, and this is what I see online. Someone you do not know posts something on a friend's wall about something. And I have admittedly engaged with some of those people. But like you said, I've done it from that place of like, I don't know your story. And I know I don't know your story. And to help me with that, actually, one time I opened what I was going to share with this person with, I'm sure that you're someone's favorite person,
yeah.
Which was as much for me to offer them a, like, I am not attacking you online because there's no tone of voice. They don't know, as much as a reminder for me about everything I was going to write after that.
Yeah. Right.
And I guess that's it. Like, it's that quality. And it's really interesting because what you're talking about, do I know your story and how are we going to engage with this? That's the approach that you're taking, no matter who you're interacting with, no matter what side of history they're on at the moment.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because then it takes the role of ally and moves it from any position of being about a savior to just about being really human.
Well, and it's interesting. If you want to get a little bit philosophical about it.
I do.
Really, if we could remove our egos, which are, in my opinion, and this is definitely a completely different conversation, but in my opinion, humans are the weakest of all animal species on this planet because we have ego.
That is a whole other discussion. Oh my goodness.
Right? So there, we've said it. Now, just to frame why I'm saying what I'm saying. But if we removed our egos, then everyone would be everyone's ally, because it would never be about what it cost you. It would be about what you're giving. And that's, to me, that's the biggest wall that stops people from being a true ally to anybody else, is fear. So fear stops them. But we know fear is just a symptom, right? Mm-hmm. Fear isn't actually anything real. Fear is a symptom of something else. It's usually a symptom of ignorance or discomfort. And often it's a symptom of, what am I willing to give up? And for a lot of people, they don't want to learn. They don't want to be uncomfortable. They don't want to stretch themselves. So those are all of the things that allyship costs you. And so if they're not willing to pay any of those tolls, then they let that fear stay wrapped around them and they're not an ally. They become the problem. And cost is completely driven by ego.
That's very interesting from a Buddhist perspective, by the way. I mean, that's like the practice there's a lot of practices around it, but there's connecting with what is egolessness. So egolessness is described as a fact of life, which is that we are egoless. Egos are something we construct. It's not tangibly there.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually exist. Yep, we can never find it.
Yep.
But when you connect with it, and everyone can and everyone does, when you connect with egolessness, that's exactly it. It is exactly as you said. You automatically become an ally because you understand that your suffering is not any more important or valid than anyone else's, and all suffering is equally in need of being addressed.
Yep.
And the brilliant example is anytime there's a natural disaster, that you see a lot of egolessness.
Yeah.
Because contrary to popular belief in like fiction and stuff, when there's natural disasters, people don't actually resort care of each other, right?
That's right.
That's what you see first.
Yes, it doesn't become a free-for-all, completely post-apocalyptic society.
Yeah.
Media is our downfall. If people would stop believing the crap that media keeps telling you is going to happen when something goes sideways, we would believe in ourselves so much more.
It would help. There's a few things that help.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Tangent again. Like,
that's fine.
Sorry.
So what support or guidance do you have to offer listeners who want to be allies? What would you recommend for people who either already think of themselves as allies and want to be better at it, or have been acknowledged as allies, or people who are like, I really want to be an ally and I'm not quite sure how?
So first, ask yourself why. It's really important to understand what's motivating you. Do you want, and this is a really hard thing for people to do, because again, it's that look in the mirror to find out your own motivation. So do people want to be a trans ally currently because it is the issue du jour? Or do you want to be an ally to the Indigenous communities because everyone's talking about reconciliation? Do you want to be an ally to immigrants because that's a huge hot button political issue? Look at your motivation. Why do you want to be an ally to a group because they are now suddenly inside your intimate circle or your family or your coworkers? Do you want to be an ally because you want to actually understand more? Are you ready to admit, I don't have a clue? So you need to know why, and you need to be honest about why. Otherwise, the rest is just going to fall apart. Figure out why, and then be ready to do the work on your own first. Learn how to find good resources in your library, on the internet, in schools, among groups. Ensure that your sources are people from these communities. Get the information you can on your own. Don't be afraid to find other people like you, right, with your privileges and with your curiosity, and research together, mm-hmm. right? Work together to find the information. See who knows what. Network. Make use of all of that. then you're going to find avenues to hear the stories firsthand. Mm-hmm. You're going to discover that there are lots of people inside those communities that are talking about it. So once you know why, and once you know something, shut up and listen. And when you're done listening, believe them, period. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, the most important thing, is believe them. When they tell you that police officers are terrifying, don't look at them sideways and go, no, they're not. That's the first place I run. You nod your head and you go, I believe you. Because their experience does not invalidate yours, and your experience does not invalidate theirs. They're just different. So to me, that, do you know what I mean? It's being motivated from the right place and being honest about that and getting that knowledge and then being the right kind of ally, being the kind of ally those communities actually need.
Awesome.
And I purposely don't include physical actions in my recommendations because lots of us aren't capable of that. Lots of people want to be an ally without attending a protest and becoming a human barrier, or without, like, don't have the ability or the capacity to create a space to hold a talk about residential schools or transphobia inside the medical system, or do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you don't have to get to that point to consider your allyship valid. Those communities will tell you your allyship is valid when you're supporting them, even if you're just doing individual support.
And I think also valuing that, like,
yeah,
it doesn't have to be a big thing for it to be significant and to matter to someone.
Yeah, very true.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Lynn Langille is the co-founder of Calgary Trans Hub and does advocacy and educational work. You can find out more by visiting calgarytranshub.com. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit caitlinschatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.